From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Peter Ames Carlin returns to From the Bookshelf this week. He previously wrote biographies of Brian Wilson and Paul McCartney, and now has written the New York Times bestseller, Bruce, a biography of Bruce Springsteen. Peter Ames Carlin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me back. It's great to talk to you again.
And congratulations on the best-selling status of Bruce. Is this your most successful book so far?
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. And that's great. I feel really happy about that. The book's been really well received, but it's anything that involves Bruce gets a lot of attention. So that's got a little bit to do with it.
Yeah, and it's been very well reviewed in the press, and that's great. And so it's not an authorized biography, but you did get the cooperation of the boss?
Exactly. I started off, it was completely unauthorized the entire time. I started off on my own, having sort of made my pro forma request for an interview and been given the pro forma refusal. So I could sort of see that happening. So I figured, well, I'm just going to go ahead and do what I wanted to do, which was a really heavily reported biography of this guy and where his life had started and where it had taken him, and try to find that nexus between a guy's regular day-to-day existence and his that point in his soul or his muse or wherever, where he can translate that into art. And in Bruce's case, write songs about that are very personal to a great extent, but also somehow universal in a way that touch other people so deeply.
So how did it come about that he was then cooperating with you?
Well, it was a very, very long process in a sense. I mean, I think what happened was, I'd always figured that part of building, doing the reporting I was doing or that I wanted to do, and talking to the people I wanted to talk to, was eventually I was going to become kind of ubiquitous, and that hopefully, people would be telling him that they had spoken to me and maybe tell them something about the questions I'd asked and what my interests were. Because I knew that my intentions were relatively pure, as biography goes. That I wasn't out there to tear the lid off of anyone or to reveal, the heroic Bruce as something less than who he, than the artist that everybody knows. I mean, because the fact is, I expect that public people and artists like that and performers have a shadow self and have an existence that's far more complicated than what they project onto the stage. And to me, that just basically goes without saying. It would be weird if it weren't true. And Bruce's music is so full of contradictions and anger and darkness and complexity. To me, there was no doubt that that's exactly who he was going to be. And so, but I was trying to do that in a way that was going to, to sort of grant him his humanity in a sense. And I think that ultimately, the more they heard about what I was doing and how thorough I was being or trying to be, the more that they became comfortable with the idea that I was, in the process of working on a kind of book that they might feel comfortable cooperating with. And so from that point, in about January of 2011, which was just about a year and a half after I started, I got a call pretty much out of the blue from Bruce's manager, John Landau. And we started, he and I met in New York for drinks about a week later. I was just coincidentally going to be out there. And things picked up from there. It became, I think, a very pleasant and very warm kind of relationship.
So what was it like for you when you walked in the door and met Bruce for the first time after having spent, I imagine, a couple of years doing research?
Yeah, well, plus also my 30 plus years of
fandom,
of being a fan and following his work and and developing a set of really, strong connections to it. Though I have to correct you, there was no walking in a door. I actually met him on the sidewalk outside his aunt's house in Freehold, New Jersey.
Outside his aunt's house?
Yeah, outside his Aunt Dora's house, uh-huh. Yeah, Clean Street.
cool.
She passed away just about a year ago, sadly. But she's a lovely, lovely person. And you know something? It was like Bruce is really good at putting you at ease. And there was obviously a certain amount of pressure that went into it. I mean, not only my sort of, you know, the fact that I'd admired this guy's work and sort of felt in that weird, you know, abstract way, sort of close to him or close to the voices that he had put on his records. But also, you know, the fact I'd worked so hard on this book and it was going to be, it was turning into such a significant thing for me. And then suddenly there he was, and it was one of those situations where you kind of really, really don't want to screw things up, you know, in some way. So there was that pressure there too, but I was also there, you know, I had a very distinct purpose, and I think he did too. And so, you know, we spent the first couple hours we spent together just mostly chatting and getting to know each other a little bit. And then started the more formal interviews the next morning. But, you know, he's really, he's just a very warm and personable guy. And, you know, I could sense, you know, but he's also extremely smart, so I could sense his feeling me out, you know, just in the way that he could sense me sort of feeling him out, I'm sure, for, you know, how I was going to sort of make this relationship work. So let's just say it was complicated and exciting and ultimately very rewarding.
So then after having submitted yourself to the personal charm of Bruce Springsteen, did that make it more difficult to be critical of him in the way you say maybe more difficult than it was to criticize Paul McCartney because McCartney didn't, you didn't walk in the room or meet Paul McCartney in front of his aunt's house?
Well, well, to some extent, yes, because you sort of want to, because to meet the guy, or at least my experience of it, under the circumstances, you know, and I saw him under a lot of very different circumstances over the next 9 months, and actually, you know, a year, you know, over the next year, I suppose. You know, he's a complicated guy, and he's intense, and sometimes he's a lot of fun to hang around with, and sometimes he's, there are other things going on, other pressures, and you can just read in his face when he is not, you know, when he's feeling a little more sour. And, you know, and he wears that stuff on his sleeve, you know, it's easy to see, you know, to look into him to some extent and get a sense of what he's feeling. I mean, so, but on the one hand, you know, I didn't want to, part of what I really don't like to do as a biographer, particularly if somebody who's an artist and an artist of that caliber, is to discomfort them in some way, sort of, or to sort of make, ridicule them for their humanity. Like, I just don't feel that that's appropriate in a lot of ways. I mean, because Bruce has never really held himself up as a super, I mean, you know, not consistently at any rate, as a heroic figure, as some sort of superhero of rock and roll. He's definitely played up that image in some ways, but there's every song of his, you know, there are no easy answers in Bruce Springsteen songs. There's no just power and glory and everything's hunky-dory, you know, there's no Pollyanna voice in his songs. His songs are all about struggle and trying to be the person that you want to be and often failing. And so that being, you know, I think that's easy to forget when you see him as the Born in the USA guy up there, you know, with the massive, you know, the sort of, with that sort of superhero physique and his very, you know, considered and cool-looking clothes that he wears. But really, you know, as he told me once, every time people talk about him like he's perfect, he feels diminished. And so he really wanted the book to be warts and all. And especially as it got toward the end of the process, was very insistent on me including any stuff that I might have thought about leaving out of the book because it might make him feel bad or uncomfortable. And I mean, and there was, he knew, it was very clear the entire time that neither he nor John Landau or anyone in his camp was going to have any control whatsoever over the contents of the book. You know, I did allow both Bruce and John to look at the manuscript before it was absolutely set in stone, but that was largely for accuracy's sake, and the understanding that was very explicit between us was if they had thoughts or questions or strong feelings, they could bring them to my attention, but that didn't mean that I was necessarily going to do anything, you know, about it.
Was there anything that they would brought to your attention?
Not from Bruce. I mean, Bruce corrected some factual things, and there were times when, you know, and this was sort of part of the process, where I'd hear stories from other people, and I'd ask for his, like, is this how you remember it? You know, what's your take on this? And there were times when, you know, there was one thing in particular, a very detailed story I got from Vinny Lopez, the first drummer in the E Street Band, about, you know, the day that Bruce fired him from the band. And, you know, and I talked to Vinny about, I've known Vinny for a long time now, and we talked about it on several occasions, and he was very clear on what his, you know, what happened and how it happened and where and when and who did what and all this kind of stuff, you know, and what was said. Bruce said, you know something, I remember that differently. He said, I might not have said all those things, but that's definitely what he heard. So keep it.
I hold you in my arms. Is a band playing? But all those words whispered, baby, just as you turn away. I saw you last night.
Talking with Peter Ames Carlin, and his new book is called Bruce. That's a biography of Bruce Springsteen. I was particularly fascinated by the period that you discuss in the book, the post-Born in the USA period, sort of maybe the maturation of Springsteen period.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. You get to a point where, you know, I think we're, you know, and he's so very conscious of his development and where he's headed and what he needs to do, you know, to get to the next place and not sort of do and redo the same things over and over again. And I think, you know, I mean, one of the sort of interesting things that I learned was, you know, from the band members, is that when they got to the end of that super triumphant Born in the USA tour in the fall of 1985, I guess, when they were playing stadiums, they did the L.A. Coliseum and I think actually those were the last shows of the tour, where Max Weinberg said that he was heartbroken afterwards because he knew that that was basically the end of the band. You know, that was the end of the road for them, because when you take these guys and you've worked with them for 15, 16, and, you know, 17 years with some of them, and you go from playing to, you know, to disinterested crowds at the Student Prince in Asbury Park to playing to 100,000 people at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, you know, where do you go after that? You know, what's left to do? Especially, you know, I mean, and that's a very complicated ecosystem inside that band, and particularly, you know, their relationship with Bruce and his relationship with them and you know, the expectations that they all have of one another. And, yeah, so there was a lot of growing up to do and a lot of, you know, soul-searching and maturing that was going on during those years in particular.
We're talking with Peter Ames Carlin, the biographer of Bruce Springsteen. And during that period, he recorded, I don't know, to me, the albums that are, although they're musically different, they are some of his richest work. I mean, Born to Run is, of course, an incredible record, but, you know, I like Tunnel of Love a lot.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Tunnel of Love is one of my favorites. You know, it's so different from the rest of his, a lot of the rest of his records, because it's so clearly autobiographical, in a way that, you know, describing, you know, his relationship with his then wife, Julianne Phillips, and his attempt, you know, I mean, it was clear over the years, I mean, listening to his songs, that he had very fiery, passionate, and often unsatisfying relationships with women. You know, and I think that, you know, that the guy had what you would call intimacy problems, you know, and he really set, I think, in his early 30s to trying to figure that out and get beyond them and marry, you know, getting involved with Julianne in the end of 1984 and then marrying her just months later, I think was, you know, taking that step to getting married was a big part of, you know, his maturation or his need to feel settled down and committed to someone in a way that he'd never been before. But the problem was he still wasn't ready for it. And Julianne, who's, you know, a lovely person and warm and smart and sweet and, you know, and terrific. I mean, she didn't do anything wrong in that relationship. And in a weird way, you know, Bruce didn't, I think, deliberately do things wrong or take her for granted or not want to be live up to the vows that he had made. But there was still that, you know, dysfunction inside of him. There's still that disturbance that made it, you know, impossible for him to, you know, to feel that connected to her. You know, maybe it was a bad, for whatever reason, it was a bad match. You know, two good people can often still result in a bad match. But, you know, but eventually, you know, not too eventually, unfortunately, that marriage fell apart, you know, due largely to Bruce's misbehavior and his problems, as he acknowledges now. And then very quickly he got involved with Patty Scalfa, and you know, and they're still married to this day, and they have three grown children, and you know, it seems like, you know, obviously they have a very rich and satisfying bond.
Well, how did it change the chemistry of the E Street Band when Bruce and Patty Scalfa got together? Because Patty Scalfa is the vocalist in the E Street Band, and yep, the only person in the E Street Band that Bruce has slept with.
Well, presumably.
I know he and Clarence were very close, but...
Well, that's true, but I still think they... Yeah, yeah, they probably stayed in separate beds. You know, yeah, it changes it. It definitely changed the chemistry. And I think, you know, some of the guys, I think Clarence in particular, felt a little put out, especially, you know, because the blossoming in their relationship between Bruce and Patty took place... like during, you know, I mean, really in the midst of the Tunnel of Love tour, to the extent where you could see it on stage, they would duet. They had this steamy duet on Tougher Than the Rest, which was like, even when he was, according to, you know, what everyone knew, still supposedly happily married to Julianne and settled down, he was up there and, you know, you'd get the sense that he and Patty were performing this, what seemed to be a very intimate and nearly erotic duet up there, and you're wondering, like, well, what, you know, what's happening up there? You know, there's so many sparks flying, the place is about to, you know, the microphone's about to burst into flame. And that's kind of where I think, she began to play such a more of a forefront role in the group, which I think also, to Bruce, reflected the content of the album and the fact that it was a story of men and women in romantic, intimate romantic, you know, in long-term relationships, that she sort of had to be up there. But for Clarence, you know, in particular, and some of the other guys, I think they feel like, you know, you're in a band that's really been a boy club for essentially, you know, almost two decades, and suddenly you have this woman stepping in and kind of taking the marquee slot that Clarence really occupied, you know, without any real competition for a very, very long period of time. And, you know, when you see the main guy in the band, you know, changing and moving and moving things around and clearly beginning to lose his connection to the band, you know, obviously there's a lot of resentment and fears that are, you know, that come to the surface.
Well, I guess that brings me to the question of what kind of a boss is the boss?
You know, in many ways, let's put it this way, Bruce contains multitudes. In many ways, he's a terrific boss. He's very, you know, I think he's, you know, that there's a very real commitment to the guys in the band and a very deep bond between them, just because, you know, you can't spend that much time on the road working that hard without, you know, becoming brothers in a sense, becoming a kind of family, you know, a very real kind of family, I think. And on the other hand, you know, he's very, you know, he's an artist and he is the main guy in the band. You know, it's sort of, you know, Max Weinberg said, you know, you can't say one album's a solo album and the others are E Street Band records. You know, sometimes the E Street Band backs him up and sometimes they don't. But, you know, as Max said, they're all solo records. You know, no one else is writing the songs. No one else is singing the songs. You know, Miami Steve Van Zandt gets a lot of, you know, he's co-produced a lot of those records, and he's, got Bruce's ear in a way I think that the other guys don't and can influence him very directly. But it's still Bruce calling the shots. So it's kind of a complicated thing, and there are times when Bruce can be very kind of self-involved, as artists are, and very sort of just dealing with his relationship with his work and trying to, you know, do his best, for, you know, uphold his commitment to that, and the band comes in, you know, a distant second place. It's kind of like he's the guy and they're his helpers, but when push comes to shove, Bruce is, you know, it's pretty clear that, you know, that his concerns trump theirs. And that's just the way it's got to be, and that's kind of the life they all signed on for.
There's no East Street Band solo album.
Well, yeah, right. You know, I mean, it's like, and the guys that work for him, you know, who are like his staff and his, you know, his road managers over the years and people who work closely with him, you know, on the one hand, he's great and he's fun and he's warm and he gets very engaged with you personally. But then on the other hand, you're still working for him and he's still in control. And so I think a lot of those relationships got really kind of complicated. I mean, especially back when he was single and, you know, his road manager was sort of a requirement of the job. When they were off the road, the road manager would live with Bruce in Bruce's house and would sort of take care of stuff, you know, would do the errands that Bruce didn't want to do and, you know, and do the laundry and keep things running, you know, kind of the... You know,
his valet. Yeah.
But on the other hand, at the end of the night or whatever, or in the evening, when you know when it was time to go off to the, you know, to the, you know, to hit the bars and play some music or hang out or have fun or cruise around and get hammered, those were the guys he went with. So they were like his, you know, they were like his crew. They were like his best buddies, but they were also his, you know, his employees.
They were on the payroll.
They were on the payroll, and if you started to screw up. You know, then that was kind of the end of your, you know, and you had to go. That was sort of the end of the friendship in a lot of ways. I mean, I think he was always very, I mean, to this day, he's very warm and you know, and happy to see those guys. But there are a lot of guys who spent a lot, you know, quantity time with the guy for a long period of time who, you know, when it was time to go, that was just it. You know, you just don't see Bruce anymore.
The events of 9/11 really seemed to spark an artistic moment for Bruce.
I think he got to a point where, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of different stories that, you know, that he likes to tell. I mean, the one about the guy, you know, when he went down to Seabright to look out up, you know, up in the New York Harbor and sort of see the smoking hole where the towers used to be, you know, and the guy drove by and just unrolled his window and yelled, "Hey, we need you, man. You know, like it's time for you to come back and you know, make some music and step in and you know, become a spiritual presence in a sense." You know, so he likes to talk about that. I think also just because, just given the fact that the, you know, the first responders, you know, and a lot of the people that got killed were really just essentially working people going in and doing their jobs. And even the guys who were, you know, executives up there in the towers, you know, you're still, you know, no matter how much, you know, you're in a different position than a guy that's, you know, working on an ambulance or working on a, you know, or being a firefighter or a police officer. But on the other hand, you know, everyone gets up in the morning and they put on whatever uniform they have to and they go to work. And I think what Bruce really felt was these workaday people just, you know, just doing their jobs and living their lives, you know, sort of died in pursuit of very simple ideals. And I think that was something that felt very, you know, very, very tragic and complicated to him. And but I think he also saw, you know, as in the title track to the album, The Rising. I mean, he talks about that, and the other song, Into the Fire, where he talks about right, you know, up into the fire, you know, and there's a kind of, you know, you do your job, you take it step by step, and then there's a kind of, you know, deliverance at the end, even if it's, a, you know, in this horrific way. You know, so I think that touched him on, you know, in a very kind of just, you know, as a working person or somebody who came out of a very working class environment and knew those people and still knows those people, you know, that he grew up with. And as somebody who sees things in a more sort of transcendent poetic way, I think that he just felt very moved by the sacrifice, you know, the day-to-day sacrifice of working day in and day out, and also just the you know, the actual sacrifice of life and limb that went into particularly the people who, you know, ran into the towers to try to help.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half mile of line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up with your hands in mine. Come on up for the rising. Come on up for the rising tonight. Left the house this morning. Bells are ringing, fill the air. I swear the cross of my call.
The book is called Bruce, or maybe it's called Bruce. And the author is Peter Ames Carlin. Peter Ames Carlin, thank you so much for talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me again.
That's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Peter Ames Carlin. His latest book, the bestseller, Bruce. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas, and I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.